you for stopping by for another episode of MFA Writers. I'm Jared McCormick, and I'm super happy to be back with a new episode today. This one was requested by Shalini Singh. Thanks, Shalini, for reaching out. So while I was hard at work finishing my thesis these last couple weeks, some of you were deciding on which MFA program to attend. The decision date is traditionally April 15th, so pretty much everyone at this point should know if they're attending a program, and if so, where. So congratulations to all of you for making it through the MFA application season. We've heard from a few listeners who said this podcast was a great help in putting together their applications and gaining a better understanding of the MFA experience in general. And I have to say, it really makes my day every time I get one of these emails or DMs. So thank you all so much for listening. You can find MFA Writers on Instagram and Twitter as well as MFAWriters.com. We love to hear from listeners, so feel free to shoot us a direct message on one of those platforms or an email at mfawriterspodcast@gmail.com. And if you have a minute to rate or review the show, the best place to do that is on Apple Podcasts. Doing so will help boost our podcast as we try to boost these amazing writers. Also, if you or someone you know would like to be a guest on the show, you can apply at mfawriters.com. Finally, as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to MFA Writers, the podcast where we talk to creative writing MFA students about their program, their process, and a piece they're working on. I'm your host, Jared McCormick. Today I'm with Gauri Awasthi. Gauri is an Indian poet and environmentalist who recently graduated with an MFA in poetry from McNeese State University. She has won awards from Sundress Academy for the Arts, Louisiana Office of Cultural Development, Breadloaf Writers Conference, and Kundiman. Her writing has been published in Quarterly West, Notre Dame Review, The Wire, BuzzFeed, and others. And she teaches the Decolonizing Poetry Workshop at Catapult. Today, Gauri has three poems to read for us.
All the poems I'm reading are from my manuscript titled The Mother Wound, and this is the title poem. The Mother Wound. The trouble is, I remember all of it. Your head split open. The one time your eye was black as Goddess Kali. The time you ran barefoot on our unpaved street and he said, look what happens to women like that. They run naked. I remember it all. The time I asked you what happened and you tore each inch of your shirt and howled and howled and howled. The time I found myself in your room telling him, your husband, my father, to stop, and he did. The trouble is, what came after will always be smaller than what happened first. Someone must have a word in a language I can read but not speak. Some answers I look for in the golden trees around our once home. Some in every woman I meet. Some in buildings wisdomed with dust. Sometimes I even turn to gods. Now after now, I turn to them, and their smallness stifles me like mine. This next poem is titled Ghazal After Babri Masjid. What gets into us when we tear down stone walls with stones, chanting for the want of a mandir? Our gods sleep peacefully in blood-washed blankets, erasing the remains of a masjid. Do we not know what happens when we burn a leaf in the forest? A funeral pyre is lit inside every mandir. We pray in languages we don't love in, shouting incantations, digging deep for a masjid. How many incense sticks burn to cleanse us of ourselves? Every firecracker in the sky blazes a mandir. The flowers etched on the pillars and domes shrivel. Beneath each was planted another masjid. And the kafir today and tomorrow the kafir. Who will you call to worship your empty walls? We killed us all for a mandir. This next one is called Sister Sonnet on Sharad Purnima. Nectar falls from the moon tonight. We stand under the pink bougainvilleas, draping every cross stitch of the cage where our dog lived and died. quiet so our thin limbs don't convulse the many faces of the moon god. We are in the veranda to collect droplets of the divine liquid, freeze it and read the pearl necklace. We smile knowing this will be a gift for Ma, who makes us believe Amrit rains from the sky tonight. Waiting, we bust like flimsy moths under the silver light, stretching our arms towards the gray sky to catch just a few drops. Waiting, we bust like flimsy moths under the silver light, stretching our arms towards the gray sky to catch just a few drops. Some maidens swallow these tiny tears tonight for good grooms with clasped hands as each globule gathers on the tip of their ripe tongues. The first drop plunges and corrodes our skin. This is how we learn to drink mercury.
Thank you, Gori. I really loved hearing you read that, and I'm really excited to talk to you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
When I read these poems, I loved all three of them, but when I read that first one, The Mother Wound, and then when I heard you read it again, there was this line that got me both times. I mean, the speaker's describing this trauma that she went through and her mother went through, and then there's this line, someone must have a word in a language I can read but not speak. And both times it just, oh gosh, it like hit me right in the heart. So I don't have a question for that. I just wanted you to know that I really love that.
Thank you. I always think that when I've written something and someone says that, I'm like, did I write that?
I get that sensation too. Sometimes I write something and I read it later or someone else reads it and mentions a line and I'm like, it almost feels like an out-of-body experience. It almost feels like the words have gone through me and that they didn't actually come from me. They came from another place.
Yeah, that's like totally how I feel about most of, especially that one poem. I feel like that about a lot. I'm like, why? And when did I write this?
Yeah, it's so interesting, and it's kind of magical and beautiful, and one of the reasons I keep coming back to writing. But I want to talk to you a bit about writing poetry in forms, which isn't something you see a ton of these days. I'm currently taking a form poetry class that's kind of kicking my butt a little bit, so I want to hear your perspective on it. Because the first poem, The Mother Wound, is not in form that I can tell. But the second two poems are in form. One is a guzzle and another is a sonnet. So is form something you turn to often in your poetry?
I think not. I came to form really late after I moved to the United States for my MFA. I think I was like intuitively maybe using a lot of repetition and like trying to engage with form, but because I didn't have the technique or like the skill to like understand form at that point, it was something that felt like occurred a lot in my work, but I couldn't like maybe chisel it in the way that I wanted it to. So I think that in the 3 years of my MFA program, I realized how much form helps. Like that whole cliche of form extending to the content, it really like works for me. And I see that happening more and more in my work, maybe because I come from a place where I was so far away from it for a long time. I did read like a lot of sonnets growing up and I listened to a lot of ghazals. So I think my understanding of sound or like language and poetry was repetitive and maybe guided intuitively by those forms. So when I learned how to like play with forms and sort of understand structure, I kind of became obsessed with it. And then it just sort of has been my experience that sometimes I write a poem like and I play to see if it is falling in a form, because I can now like notice repetitions that I feel like, oh, can be better guided by a form. So oftentimes it's not intentional. Like this ghazal I wrote, the ghazal I just read, Ghazal After Babri Masjid, I had been thinking about the demolition of the masjid by the right wing in India and the Hindutva groups, and I had been thinking of how a place of worship, like the fact that masjid means mosque and mandir means temple, and I kept thinking of like growing up it meant like both of them meant the same thing to me, as in like being a place of worship, which like I was always around in the area I grew up in. So I kind of like was fixated on that repetition. And when I started writing about it, I realized that I was using those words. and the sequence in which they occurred. Like, it was happening in the poem two times. And I think I took it to workshop, actually, and people were like, this is a ghazal. And I think that's what had, like, made me realize that a lot of them have, like, an intuitive form. And they are not necessarily, like, the pure form, or they don't exactly follow the radif or, like, the kafiya, but they have, like, all the other qualities of it in the sonnet. So I think that I really love, like, learning all the forms and then, like, dismantling them to how I want to use them, because that's what language is for.
Well, I was going to ask about that, actually, because before taking this class that I'm in, I thought forms were really strict. Like, you had to very closely adhere to the rules or it didn't count. But that's not really the case, right? Like, the poems you read break from the traditional rhyme structure a bit. So how do you decide when to stick to the form and when to break the rules?
I think that mostly I try to be really respectful of the form, in the sense that I think that a lot of, like, when I teach decolonizing poetry, and I think this might be, like, tying into some of the other things we wanted to talk about, but when I looked at forms, I think that a lot of people feel, and rightly so, like, a lot of pushback against traditional forms because they have this history of oppression and being extremely, like, white, and also being, like, the kind of poetry that is accepted. And I think that when I came to form from the perspective of looking at non-Western forms, because I was not raised in this environment. So I understand, like, the pushback that is felt with, like, these forms. But then I realized that if you can break these structures and in how, like, they're adapted differently in the West, or, like, what happens to a form when it travels and is adapted by someone in another part of the world, I think those were questions that motivated me to, like, break the form. And I think that I feel more, like, comfortable in breaking the ghazal because it feels like my own form, as opposed to, like, maybe breaking from a high bun. And I think that what I really try to think of is that if I am, like, doing disservice to the form in the original language, and that's something, like, I really try to be mindful of. If I'm, like, using, I think, a ghazal to maybe write a poem that is colonizing, I feel like that's a disservice to the form. But I feel like if you're doing the work of the subject matter, like communicating something important in the sense that it is aiding the form or the culture, or, like, not basically, like, appropriating it, I feel like that you have the leeway to play with it, and the form allows you to play with it really comfortably and make a point. So I think that's basically, like, how I feel comfortable doing it, and how I decide how much I want to play with it is honestly, like, when I see it on the page, if it's even necessary.
Well, you mentioned that you were introduced to some non-Western forms of writing and poetry and songs at a young age. You were born and raised in India, and you told me that your grandmother introduced you to bhajans, religious hymns, couplets, and bhakti poetry, which helped aid in your craft years later. So what was your grandmother like, and how influential was she to your writing?
I think that all my grandparents have been, like, super influential in, like, shaping the kind of work I do. My maternal grandmother is the only grandparent I have alive. She's my nani. That's the word for maternal grandmother in Hindi. And my paternal grandma passed away really recently in January. Growing up with her, like, my paternal grandmother and my paternal grandfather was a really blessed experience, in the sense that they were just religious enough to the point where they would not, like, impose their teachings on you, but you were told a lot of stories. So growing up with my grandmother in particular was really, I didn't realize consciously that it was guiding so much of, like, how I see the world. But she read a lot of, like, poets like Mirabai, and who writes to Krishna, which is one of the Hindu gods, about, like, love poems and being a devotee. And then she also introduced me to Kabir. And my uncle used to listen to a lot of tapes of Kabir, who I, like, write about a lot also in my thesis, because he's the in-between, I guess, and more accepted, even in the, like, religious divide between Hindus and Muslims in India, and there are like conflicts about what religion he totally belongs to. And I think that growing up with her in that environment where she introduced me to those poets or saints as they're like thought of, and listening to like epics of like Ramayana, Mahabharata, and like looking at like characters from the perspective of like storytelling, and like her just telling basically like a lot of stories to me before bedtime, and sort of sharing songs about like devotion, really like created a sense of rhythm. I also listened to a lot of ghazals with her, but I would definitely say that bhakti poetry, like a lot of songs written to gods and goddesses, and which I think kind of is like the tradition of, what is it, an ode. And I think that now when I look at ode as a form, I think, oh, this definitely exists in my culture too. Or I've always heard like odes to kings, but I just didn't have the language to it. Or odes to gods or to the water, because a lot of inanimate objects are like worshipped in the culture. All of those things like sort of created a world for me which was very alive in some ways, and I think she helped like create that.
Well, you told me before the interview that bhakti poetry involves writing love poems to the divine, so that kind of sounds like what you're talking about here. So you told me that you still draw upon that today when, in your words, you write poems to love and document the hauntings of your memory. So I was curious if you could tell us a bit about bhakti poetry and how you see it manifesting in your work today.
So, like I said, bhakti poetry is writing poems to gods and a lot of loved ones. And I think that because I learned classical dancing growing up, it also became like sort of where it came from to me. And a lot of the songs in that are sort of bhakti songs, which are like singing praise of the divine and are almost looking at the divine as like a lover. And I'm honestly writing all poems. I think that I had a lot of maybe shame about writing love poems as a child, because I think I came to poetry as like writing poems for my crushes, which I think a lot of us do, or like scribbling like secret diary notes to like a crush who'd probably never read them. But I think that that's how it started for me too. I cannot deny it, and I was really embarrassed about it for a really long time, that this is how I came to poetry, and I came to it from a space of love. And I think I still feel that way in that night. And if I'm writing, I didn't actively think about like who I'm writing towards or where I'm writing to. But I think that, I think it was a Diana Kui Gwen workshop I did, and she made me like really rethink who I'm writing towards and who I'm writing for. And I think that when I look back at my manuscript now or the work I created during my MFA, I feel like I'm writing to my mother sometimes. I feel like that makes all of the work love poems in a sense, because I'm telling her things I probably can't say to her or don't have the language to tell her in a way that would not hurt her. So I think that all of it has definitely manifested. And even when I'm writing like a poem to a friend, or if I'm contemplating, even if in poems that I'm contemplating violence or dealing with violence, I do think that most of them come from a place of wanting love or wanting to be loved.
I'm curious about, you know, you mentioned that you got into poetry writing love poems like a lot of us did. But like, did you write a lot of poetry when you were younger? Is that something you were encouraged to do? Like, how did you first get into poetry, and what was it like writing poetry in India?
I think that I remember my mom really encouraging me to write poetry, but my first distinct memory of writing a poem is like when I was in grade 3 and there was like a poetry writing competition. And I wrote a poem about like India and like how different cultures, it had a very bad rhyme scheme that I still remember. And I think that is like my first experience of like thinking or like consciously saying I'm writing a poem. And then I continued to like write from like that age. And I think a lot of it was just like personal, which I think a lot of poetry or like poets start writing for themselves. And I think even though like that competition pushed me to write like a first poem, it was not like on display or anything. And it was mostly like an internal process. So I like wrote for myself in a diary for a really long time, like until all through school, basically. And a lot of it was love poems and really cheesy. But I think it wasn't, in India, there was no like creative writing degree. There still isn't. Like there are one or two schools which have like an undergrad creative writing. And I want to say that English is not encouraged to be studied because it's just not something that will pay you that much money, and you're trying to like break out of a system which is in which you are like just trying to sustain. So it was not encouraged. So I basically studied, I finished my schooling, was writing poetry, but I didn't know about MFAs at the time, and I didn't know I could study creative writing. So I just wanted to study English, ended up studying journalism, and then I studied journalism for 3 years. And it was my professor in the journalism program, he was my department head, Dr. Sudhakar Solomon Raj. He helped me look at MFAs, and he really encouraged me to like continue writing, because I wrote for like the school magazine and things like that, which I think really like made me realize that I wanted to pursue. And I think like having mentors like all through undergrad and in the MFA has really like helped me. I don't think I would have been able to find the direction in where I was because I didn't have access to it. I didn't know it was something I could do. And I started like looking up some writers I really loved who were Indian. Like I remember like Googling Tishani Doshi and Jeet Thayil and being like, I want to see what they studied. And a lot of them were like MFA. I remember Jeet Thayil being like MFA, Sarah Lawrence. And I was like, okay, this is a degree I can do to maybe get here. And then I sort of just looked at like funded programs and applied.
So after moving to the States, how did you see your poetry changing? Like in what ways did you find your poetry evolving once you moved to the United States?
I think that what really happened is, I was like so strange that you asked me that. I was recently talking to a friend about it, and she's a visual artist. And I was thinking that so much of my work before I moved was so external. Like it was always looking out, and I was always like watching something in my immediate environment. And when I moved and I had so much distance from my homeland, like thousands of miles, I just looked inwards. It just became like, it was just like the opposite in so many ways. And I feel like I don't know what like determined that, because I'm sure I like have the distance to look at myself as an outsider now because I'm so far away from my home place. But I think that's the drastic change that I noticed, that a lot of the works, like even if I was writing about war or like love, I was writing about seeing it and not experiencing it. And when I moved, I started writing about my own experience. So I think what it gave me, like moving to the United States, which I'm very grateful for, gave me like a super safe distance to look at myself critically and my environment and what I want to change about it or what I want to write about, and maybe talk about the grief it has caused me without it like hurting anyone in my immediate environment. So I think that it really gave me a lot of distance in the work, and a distance which helped me look inwards, which wasn't like I'm noticing and writing about like seeing outward only.
Right. Well, in 2021, you graduated with an MFA in poetry from McNeese State University, which is home to the oldest MFA program in Louisiana. It's a 3-year program, and they also offer a track in fiction. You told me that pursuing the MFA was your reason to leave India and move to the United States, which just takes an immense amount of courage. So I wanted to hear you talk about that, and I'm sure it wasn't easy to move here and attend that program, but maybe you could talk about that experience a little bit.
Yeah, I think that because I was so clear that this was like the only thing I wanted to do, it was very matter of fact, like, I have to do this. There's no other thing I see myself doing. And I wanted to like spend 3 years, like just what I thought of as like working on my craft. And when McNeese offered, it felt like a dream, to be honest, to be like in a space where I can just work on the craft and not think about many things. So I was happy to move and relieved to move because I really needed to move. And I think that when I came to Lake Charles, I know a lot of my peers were like, I remember talking to a friend who was in the summer. He was also in the program and he was visiting India for the summer, has some family there. And I remember meeting him and he was like, it's such a small town. And I met him in Mumbai, which is like one of the biggest Indian cities. And he was like, Lake Charles is a really small town and you might not like enjoy it and things like that. And I was like, not moved at all. And I was like, I don't care. I just want to like study and work on the craft. So I'm going to go. And I think that in the program for like, I think it, when you move from another country, it takes you a long time to like understand the city and like the culture. So, and yeah, I don't think I can deny that it was difficult. It was difficult in the sense that I think I mentioned to you that I remember going to the international office and the international office advisor being like, you're the first students who are international to be in this program. And we were like, wow. So then it was like a bit of a wow moment, but, and it was hard like to maybe adjust to that environment immediately. I also think that it helped that I had another student in the fiction program with me. And because she was from another country too, it sort of became like, we can figure this together at moments when we had like international student affair issues. So it was, and I also think that I almost always turned to Amy for like most of the problems I had, and she always helped me. So I think that what really helped was that it was a small department and a small program, because me and another poet were the only two poets that year, and there were two fiction writers that year. So the class size was so small that it was really accessible. Like, I could reach out to my professor and they would go like beyond to help me if I even needed to like figure out maybe groceries in the city, which I don't think they needed to do at all. And I don't know how many professors do that, but I remember them like driving me to the airport if I have to go home. So I think that the program and the chair made the program like really feel like home for me. And it really like guided my experience of being there. I think that if I didn't have like a supportive faculty, I wouldn't have felt the same way. But because they were so nice and so willing to help and go out of their way to help you, it made the experience like really fulfilling.
Yeah. It definitely makes a huge difference having the support of the faculty and your cohort and the program. I'm also curious about, you know, we've talked about forums already, but I'm curious how your background in non-Western forums and pedagogy affected your transition to the MFA program, and what it was like taking classes in the U.S. compared to India.
Oh, I remember like a big shift in terms of American literature to, sorry, like British literature to American literature, because I think that I was more exposed. I was for sure more exposed to British literature than I was to American literature. When I came here, I learned a lot of American literature and I was introduced to Toni Morrison and Alice Walker and a lot of really beautiful Southern writers. And I think that experience I really valued. I think that the shift at first was a bit disorienting in like learning newly about American literature and almost daunting because I was also doing the MA. So I was like learning a lot of literary theory in my first semester, which I had not done before because my background was also in journalism. There were students who like had studied English literature in undergrad and had like that sort of experience. But I think that over, like, after my first semester, I had a better hang of, like, understanding theory, which sort of, like, helped. And also, I had no experience. I don't know, like, if this is... I feel like in American schools, they teach you APA and MLA and in undergrad, and I didn't have that experience either. So I think those formatting and theory things were, like, hard for me as an international student because I didn't have that experience before. But in the first year of the MFA program at McNeese, you work at the writing center and you do not teach. So that experience helped me in learning MLA and APA and sort of transitioning into, like, format and theory, because I was working on it, like, on an individual basis and tutoring students. So I sort of learned it then. So I think that helped me. And I feel like... initially, like, when I was studying, I had some really good courses. Like, one of the courses I had was in my first semester was Mothering in American Literature. That was taught by Dr. Wendy Wellen. And she basically curated a wonderful list of novels which were talking about mothering. And I think that really, like, even helped guide my thesis later. She was one of my thesis advisors. And so I think that the courses were really, like, helpful. I did feel like a lack of world literature courses, and I brought it up with the department, and we talked about, like, doing an individual case study, because there wasn't a South Asian studies faculty at that point at the university. So because I wanted to, like, study Indian literature only, or, like, literature from South Asia, and my department head was good about, like, doing an individual credit course with me solely. And I know that one of my colleagues who was a Nigerian student did, like, an independent study with her professor on Nigerian authors only. So I think that when I did feel a lack, I was able to, like, get an individual course, which helped me, like, work on what I wanted to. What I think is or can be frustrating is, like, not having that option, or, like, wanting a course and not having that, like, discussion.
There's been a lot of needed dialogue recently about how the workshop model is made by and for white writers. Craft in the Real World by Matthew Salicis came out recently, and the Anti-Racist Writing Workshop by Felisa Rose Chavez is a great book that I encourage people to read. We had her on the show last year, and you're currently teaching a decolonizing poetry workshop with Catapult. So I was wondering if you could talk about your experience workshopping at McNeese and the ways in which you hope to see the workshop model evolve.
I definitely think about the workshop model a lot, and I think one of the reasons I wanted to teach a decolonizing poetry workshop was because I wanted the experience of being in a writing space in which I was not really being, like, necessarily, like, edited on a line level based on the, I guess, understanding of the other person of my work, or, like, solely based on, like, the preconceived perception they have about work from a certain part of the world, or they have someone else's understanding of their style and what they prefer. So I think that in my first few years workshopping at McNeese, when I felt like I'm still figuring my voice, I did have, like, a few experiences in workshop where I felt like, it was mostly feedback by, I want to say, white men, which was, like, not comfortable, which makes you feel like you don't know what you're doing. And I feel like there is a lack, because I also, like, am from a different part of the world, I feel like there was a lot of expectation to explain things, or, like, italicize words which don't make sense in your language or don't make sense in English. And I think that I didn't realize the need to, like, push back against them, or, like, how essential it would be in, like, finding my own voice to, like, keep it that way, until I actually read a lot of poets writing in Spanish who, like, were code switching at the time. And I remember, like, I think it was my first AWP, and I met a poet who's written the book Heart Like a Window, Mouth Like a River. And she said to me that you should never have the sort of responsibility of explaining yourself in a poem all the time. And it's not, like, the right responsibility to have. And we were talking about like a particular poem that I had shown her. And I think that experience, like really at the end of like my first year, really made me realize that I didn't need to do that in my work. I also think that when I went back to workshop and I expressed that this is not something I'm wanting to do in my work, it was taken well. And I was really conscious of like not performing my country or culture. I didn't want to like do a poem or like make poems about like teas or snakes and like, you know, those things which are like stereotypical to the image of India or like yoga. And I didn't, and I think that those were like that kind of consciousness was built by like talking and writing with more people who came from different backgrounds, more people of color, and who felt the same way in workshops. And I think in my second year, my workshop was, I want to say 50% people of color. And I think they were all also writing from different backgrounds. Like the person in my cohort I was writing with, who's also a brilliant poet, Megan Gonzalez, she was writing about being a Mexican American. And I think that sort of like interacting with the work of people in my cohort who were doing similar work really helped me. And I think in my first year, I just felt like unsure and uncomfortable with the fact that I was doing it. And because of like some of the feedback I received, but I did think that whenever I went back to my thesis guide about those things, she was supportive and we could have like a conversation about it that would at least help me think about it. I think that that experience was important. I do think that the model is still like made for a specific audience. I do think that how it's looked at in the sense of like, especially like looking at like tough workshops, I don't think that sort of practice helps anyone. And that's why like I wanted to create, I remember talking to my thesis advisor and telling her that I really want to take a workshop with a woman of color. And that year, like after I graduated, when I got Bread Loaf and I did Tin House, I did Bread Loaf with Paisley Redcar and I did Tin House with Diana Khoi Gwen. And that experience also like felt so different in terms of like how the workshop was structured, because I remember they both had like a sort of salon model, which was like you read the work. So sort of like, you know, how we're talking, you read the work and you like tell them where it's coming from, because you understand that this poet is basically showing you a part of the work. And this is an ongoing work, which I think a lot of workshops lack, that they don't acknowledge the fact that this is just a part of someone's work. It's not like this is representative of a small part of their whole body of work. And it has to be in sync with maybe the other writing or like the other tone they have, as you would maybe do in a fiction manuscript. But in poetry, I think the expectation is that this poem should exist in the, I don't know, realms of the perfect poem, which often is understood as like, has like, I think there's a certain understanding of it being following like this certain tradition of like poetry. And I think that like really imposes, I think it creates a bad workshop model. And I really think that having a model where you can read your work, you can speak and you can talk about like what's working, what's not working, how you're feeling really helps the poet feel seen. I think there's an expectation in workshop to like dissociate yourself from the work completely coming in and like not taking anything personally, but I don't think that acknowledges the silence people face in their everyday lives and how personal, truly personal poetry is. So in the decolonizing poetry workshop, we study a lot of poets of color. We mostly study poets who are writing about non-white experiences and all writing about marginalization. We also study poets from other parts of the world and sort of look at forms in their original languages, even when we can't translate, to just understand line structures and things like that. And that guides the workshop, which then also is based on a model where people read their work and then I tell them to like bring three questions they have about the work, so we can specifically give the writer what they want. Because sometimes I think we spend a lot of time meditating on like a question mark in a workshop and are like after it, and maybe that's not the poet's concern and maybe that's not what they want out of their workshop and time. Maybe that is something they can resolve on their own. And I think that it is beneficial for both a reader and a poet to have that sort of guiding experience. I think it makes me a better reader when I know I'm able to give the poet what sort of feedback they want. So that is how like the decolonizing poetry workshop runs. But it's been like such a great experience, like learning experience for me to teach that workshop, because I've met so many people who have like who've written like beautiful questions which have made me think about like my work in a different way. So I think that the workshop model, like traditionally, it also doesn't allow that exchange of information, because you're like not talking during the time you're being workshop, and then you're not supposed to like defend your work, which I understand, but I think it becomes like there is no conversation, there is no nuance in those like discussions. They just become like, this is right and this is not, and then the class is sort of divided. And then I think with modern poetry there's so much like leeway to be wrong all the time.
Well, I imagine being an international student coming to the States, having to deal with all of that culture shock transition, if you didn't have a program and a faculty that was super supportive, it would make it even more difficult. So I'm really glad that like you had that support of the faculty, and it sounds like that was a big help. And I wanted to talk a bit about funding at McNeese. In general, being a fully funded MFA program means that all students admitted get a full tuition waiver and a stipend, either through a fellowship or a teaching assistantship. According to McNeese's website, everyone in the program gets a teaching assistantship and a partial tuition waiver. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit about that. How much money were you paying each semester after funding?
I think I was paying around $1,500 a semester after funding. And my stipend was around $4,000 a semester because I was an international student. If you're an American student, you can also, like, you have more hours to work. I'm only allowed to work 20 hours on campus as an international student, so I can't, like, work a library job at the same time, which I understand is not ideal if you're doing an MFA. But a lot of students did pick, like, the rest 10 hours in the library and things like that. And Lake Charles, the thing was that it was really cheap as a city, so it was livable, but not comfortably livable, to be honest. Like, it would have helped to have more stipend for sure to make it more comfortable. But it was just like making ends meet at that point for me.
And you were also teaching, right? What kinds of classes do students teach in the MFA program?
The first year we're not teaching. Like I mentioned, we're working at the writing center, and I think that is really good. I really appreciated having that experience. I did not want to be thrown into teaching my first year of like moving into a new country and sort of like transitioning. And I also like learned a lot through that tutoring experience and became like really comfortable with like students and campus, which like helped me, I think, do well in my first semester of teaching. I felt like I was doing a good job. So I think that the second and the third year are when you're teaching, and you basically teach 101 and 102, so the basic English level courses, composition writing, and you can work with the poetry workshop for undergrad with your professor, or like the fiction workshop if you want to in your third year.
Well, one unique thing about McNeese is they allow students to obtain an MA in English at the same time as the MFA. So how does that program work?
That, I think, was a very great experience. Maybe like the one thing I recommend everyone at McNeese to do. I think most students at McNeese end up doing the MA if they don't already have it. It's basically like you can take extra courses in the first and the second semester. You can even take them until your third year. Like, it's a three-year program, and the third year is mostly like a thesis year. So you can take like thesis credits. But if you want to finish the MA in 3 years, that's fine too. You can just like take extra credits to meet the MA. And it's not like a lot of extra credits. A lot of credits in the MA and MFA overlap. If I wanted to finish in 2 years, which I did, I finished my MA in 2 years. So I just had the last year for my thesis. But then the pandemic happened and the hurricanes. So it didn't like give me a lot of great time. But I think that the intent, most people do that. So they have like a lot of time in their third year to just work on the thesis and teach like two classes. The MA is really nice because I think it has been great to like learn and read about like writers from different parts of the world in like a critical theory review type perspective, and then like come back to your own writing in a creative writing class in an MFA and like think about how those works interact or what they mean to your own work, and sort of like I think that building your own sort of, I want to say, lineage of writers is what happens if you study, if you're doing the MFA alongside, because you come across work because you're reading so much for the MA and you sort of bring that experience into your writing. So I thought it was really important for me to do like both degrees at the same time.
I'm curious about other opportunities at McNeese as well. So it looks like there's a visiting writer series and a chance to work on the McNeese Review and perhaps potential funding to attend writing conferences around the country. So can you tell us a bit about those opportunities and any that you took advantage of in your time at McNeese?
Yeah, I went to all of the AWPs and it was fully funded. And they funded our travel and the hotel and the meals. So that was really nice when I did the... I really enjoyed my AWPs because of McNeese. And I also did like two literature conferences. I did SCMLA during my time at McNeese, and that was also reimbursed by the university. And because I was doing the MA, so I did like a literature conference sort of thing, and it was also funded by McNeese. I did work on the McNeese Review, and I think that what I do currently in terms of editorial work was greatly determined by that, because I had worked in like editorial before, but it wasn't like such a detailed experience. I started as a poetry reader for the McNeese Review my first year, and then I transitioned to being the poetry editor in my third year, and it was a great experience to learn with the professor who was the editor-in-chief of the McNeese Review at the time, was Chris Lowe. He's a great editor, and it just was a really good experience because also we edited the issue through like the pandemic and the hurricanes, and it was still like something that could come together, and it was really nice to like learn how to read and sort of go through like a submission queue and sort of pick work and interact with people, take, I guess, like get feedback from everybody on the team. And it was a very nice collaborative experience. And then I had fun soliciting work too, which I had not done before on the editorial level. And it was a nice experience because I could like reach out to people and they would send work. It was a really nice experience. And I think that pushed me to like sort of explore publishing more. And when I was in my last year, I applied to be a poetry reader at The Offing, where I'm now the editorial assistant. And I think McNeese Review like prepared me for those things because I learned how to like manage timetables, create a timeline. So, and I love The Offing, so I still do that editorial work.
And, you know, you've mentioned a couple times during this conversation, Lake Charles, Louisiana. What's it like living there? And I'm curious if there's a strong sense of community in the city and within the program.
I think that there is definitely a strong sense of community within the program. And it feels very like the professors are very warm and they make you feel at home. I do think that most people feel strange about Lake Charles because it is a strange and small city and there isn't much to do. But I just always tell people, to be very honest, that it was great for me because it was extremely quiet. And I think I needed no distraction to finish my thesis. And you literally have nothing else sometimes. So you have to write. And I think a lot of my colleagues or like classmates agreed that this is the place to write, but probably like hard to live in because it's so quiet. Yeah, it was great for me. And I also think that there were like two local students at the time that I was at McNeese. So I think they helped me see the community around Lake Charles, like Lafayette. There were poetry readings at University of Louisiana, Lafayette, ULL, and some in NOLA. And I think because if the community was interwoven and it was small, like there were only so many poets in those universities and like MFA programs. So it helped to like, was nice to like go to those readings and have that sort of experience. And I think ULL, especially as a program, ULL and McNeese do like a lot of stuff together in Lafayette. So there are those opportunities, but it's definitely small. They also have like, the school has their independent reading series, which happens at a cafe in Lake Charles, which is also sweet. But I do think that those opportunities are like lesser, and I don't know how much. I think place plays a role in like sort of your work and writing. For me, I needed the choir, so it worked out really well. But maybe for someone who's looking for more social experience, it might not be the best place to be in.
Well, I'm not going to lie. I had to look up Lake Charles on Google Maps to see exactly where it was because I wasn't sure.
I don't blame you. I think I remember showing my father like the first time that this is the school I got the invite from, and he was like, I don't think this is a real place. I was like, it is. But he's been, I've told him multiple times that aren't you so grateful that, you know, I ended up here, because I am. And my younger brother goes to school there now his undergrad. So now he has no complaints.
That's great. Well, like I mentioned, you graduated last May 2021. So what have you been up to since graduating? I hear you're teaching a workshop this August through the Nebraska Poetry Society.
Yeah, I have. I'm on an OPT because I'm an international student. So I'm on a training period visa, which ends in July. And I have also been working at a literary agency, and I'm working as an editorial assistant, where I sort of, it's more like mostly nonfiction oriented. So it's very different from the work I was doing in terms of like poetry and what I do with Catapult or what I do in the teaching workshop. But it's nice because it has like the same kind of editorial experience I got from McNeese Review and what I do at The Offing. So that's what I do for a living. And I teach the Catapult workshop. It happens like every semester. I'm going to probably teach it again in the summer. And I'm teaching the Nebraska Poetry Workshop, which is just a one-day workshop. That is a workshop I have not taught before, so I'm excited to teach that workshop. I'm going to basically teach eco-poetry. And I have always, like, that was one of the topics of interest to me. I've been interested in plant humanities and how what role poetry plays in like plant humanities, basically about South Asian poets writing about like nature or plants, but in a way that calls for a current climate consciousness. And I think that I'm excited to reach that workshop because I'm going to be like reading some of those works with people who are interested in the same issues, and also like just talking about what role the climate crisis plays in writing about the environment now, because a lot of poets are constantly like calling attention to those issues, and it has become such a primary concern. I also think that the so-called global south has experienced climate change for like the largest time without it going unnoticed, and I think that I want to like sort of evaluate those things in that workshop and sort of like see what it means to like write about the climate and the environment in a time like this.
Well, that's great. And we'll be sure to put a link to that on our website, mfawriters.com, so listeners can find it. Before we go, I want to give you the last word on McNeese. The thing I ask every guest when they come on is, what is one thing you think the program does really well and one way in which you think they can improve?
I think the one thing that the program does really well is that they give you a lot of resources to sort of spend time with your writing, in the sense that the faculty will really support your growth. And I think that is very essential for any writing program. I think that having great faculty for me meant that I am able to write and I'm able to ask questions without like feeling like I don't know anything. And I think that accessibility in terms of like having a writing community really like shaped my understanding of poetry in this part of the world. And I now understand like the importance of having that community. So I think that McNeese does a really good job because of their faculty. One thing that they could do better on would probably be like opening up more literature type teaching courses. I think that teaching 101 and 102 is great experience for maybe like the second year, but I do think that in the third year, students should probably be teaching like lit courses so that they have that experience when they go away from the program. And also because I think when you're already like studying literature and both like creative writing, I think you have the sort of like equipment or skill to like apply it. And I think it would be great. It would be great for like a student to like sort of see what they've learned and apply it in a classroom setting. And I think if that happened, it would automatically mean like, it would make like the thesis year more exciting for a lot of students because they're writing and then just teaching literature, which feels more in sync than teaching literature and writing and teaching like composition, you know? So not to disown composition, but it gets boring and it's structured in a certain way because there are like so many rules you have to follow.
Well, Glory, it's been really nice talking to you. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm super grateful.